16. The Anti-Custer. Ranald Slidell McKenzie came from one of those prodigiously overachieving eastern seaboard families that seemed connected, in profound and unaccountable ways, to everyone who was anyone in the corridors of power. His grandfather, John Slidell, was a Manhattan bank president and political power broker in New York City. His uncle, John Jr., became the most powerful man in Louisiana politics, a U.S. senator, and the top advisor to President James Buchanan. McKenzie's Aunt Jane married Commodore Matthew Perry, the man who opened Japan to the West. Aunt Julia married a rear admiral. Uncle Thomas became Chief Justice of Louisiana. His father, Alexander McKenzie Slidell, who reversed his last and middle names at the request of a maternal uncle, was both a prominent naval commander and a well-known writer of histories and travel books, who once had the distinction of being court-martialed for hanging the son of the Secretary of War for mutiny. His mother came from splendid bloodlines, too. Her grandfather had been Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Alexander Hamilton. McKenzie thus grew up in elevated society, though his father's death when he was 8 put the family in more or less permanent financial difficulty. He was a frail, shy, smallish, unhealthy boy with the pale skin and transparent eyes of his Scottish forebears and a speech impediment that some described as a lisp and others as a slight stutter. He attended Williams College in Massachusetts, hoping to be a lawyer, but the family's straitened finances would not allow him to finish. After 2 years, he arranged for a transfer to West Point, which paid a salary in addition to providing free education. He matriculated there in 1858. Against all of his family's expectations, he performed brilliantly, graduating first in his class of 28 cadets. He was considered by many in his class to be the all-round ablest man in it. He never grew much. As an adult, he was a slim 5 feet 9 inches tall, the limit for a cavalryman, but he lost some of his shyness, made friends more easily, played pranks, and ran with a lively crowd. His talent in mathematics secured him a position as assistant professor while he was still a student. In the tiny, cloistered world of the military academy, he undoubtedly knew the immodest and trouble-prone young man, one class ahead of him, named George Custer, though there are no records of their relationship. The two officers could not have been more different. Custer was exuberant, vainglorious, and outrageous. McKenzie was dark and complex, deeply private and inwardly turned, and never built for public adulation. Custer was a horrendous student, and the word able was not the first that came to mind when people described him, more like libidinous and alcoholic. When he graduated in 1861, he ranked 34th out of 34 students in his class, having accumulated a class-high 726 demerits. In spite of these gaping differences, the two men were, oddly, twins of fate. Born less than a year apart, their careers mirrored each other virtually every step of the way, from their money-strangled ambitions to study law, to their West Point days, to their heroism and precociousness in the Civil War, where they fought in the same campaigns, and ultimately to their Indian fights in the West. The parallel lines crossed only a few times, last occurring after the disaster at Little Bighorn, where McKenzie was sent north to, in effect, clean up Custer's mess. McKenzie's graduation in 1862 landed him in the middle of the Civil War, and over the next 3 years, he climbed the ranks with breathtaking speed. He served in the Engineer Corps at the battles of Manassas, 2nd, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, and Gettysburg, receiving brevet promotions that quickly boosted him to the rank of major. A brevet rank was temporary, often given on the battlefield to increase the officer corps in times of emergency. The idea was to keep the Army from becoming, in peacetime, top-heavy with officers. Still, he was bored by engineering work and longed for command. He finally got it at the Battle of Cold Harbor in June 1864, when he was breveted to lieutenant colonel and given charge of the 2nd Connecticut Volunteer Artillery. He was 23 years old. he soon proved himself to be both dazzlingly competent and almost recklessly brave. At the Battle of Winchester, where Custer also fought, he seemed to court destruction all day long, wrote one of his soldiers. With his hat held aloft on the point of his saber, he galloped over the 40-acre field through a perfect hailstorm of rebel lead and iron with as much impunity as though he had been a ghost. At one point, a Confederate artillery shell cut the horse he was riding in half. Wounded in the thigh, he bound the gash up and kept on fighting. With just a few months left in the war, he was given his first major command, the Cavalry Division of the Army of the James. By Appomattox, he held the brevet ranks of Brigadier General of the Regular Army and Major General of the Volunteers, making him the highest-ranking officer in West Point's class of 1862. He was only 24 years old. He had been breveted 7 times in less than 3 years, a pace of promotion almost unheard of in the Army, and which beat Custer's 5 brevets, though Custer ended with the same rank. Mackenzie was, moreover, one of Grant's favorites. "I regarded Mackenzie as the most promising young officer in the Army," Grant later wrote in his memoirs. Graduating at West Point, as he did, during the second year of the war, he had won his way up to command of a corps before its close. This he did upon his own merit and without influence. Something else happened to Mackenzie during the war. Like so many other young men, he hardened. He lost his easy affability, his prankishness, and much of his good humor. This was undoubtedly caused in part by the bloodshed and suffering he witnessed from 1862 to 1865, but it was more directly related to a series of gruesome, debilitating wounds he received, and from which he would never fully recover. He was wounded on 6 different occasions. At Manassas, he was shot with a 50-plus caliber bullet through both shoulders, a terrible internal wound that should have killed him. He lay where he fell for 24 hours before being rescued. He was hit in the leg with an artillery shell at Winchester and later wounded in the chest by shrapnel. Another artillery shell took off the first 2 fingers of his right hand. The pain never left him, and it changed him. His first command felt the brunt of this change. When he inherited it, the 2nd Connecticut had been a beaten, neglected, and demoralized unit. After Cold Harbor, Mackenzie drilled them mercilessly and punished them liberally. The men hated him. He was so hard on them that some even plotted to shoot him in the next battle. "By the time we reached the Shenandoah Valley," wrote one of his lieutenants, "he had so far developed as to be a greater terror to both officers and men than Early's grape and canister." At Winchester, the regiment fought brilliantly. Its losses were higher than any other regiment in the fight. The men also witnessed Mackenzie's astounding bravery. After that, the talk of mutiny stopped. His men did not like him, many feared him. But like all men in subsequent Mackenzie commands, they always believed they had a better chance with him in battle than with other commanders. He was not what West Pointers would describe as a martinet. He was neither vain nor arrogant nor capricious. He was just brutally demanding, the boss from hell. After the war was over, Mackenzie remained in the Army, reverting to his actual rank of captain, as did Custer, and building harbor defenses in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. In 1867, he was promoted to colonel and took command of the 41st Infantry, a black regiment that soon moved to Texas. He was stationed at various different forts there and saw his first limited Indian engagements in 1869 and 1870. They were really nothing more than skirmishes. He spent a good deal of his time sitting on courts-martial in San Antonio. In 1871, he got his big break. He was given command of the 4th Cavalry on the frontier, an event that was a direct consequence of President Grant's increasing impatience with the peace policy. It was no accident that the man he considered his most aggressive and effective officer was being placed squarely in the path of Comanche war parties. The record of federal officers on the frontier in those days showed just how lethal the West still was, even for mounted bluecoats. In 1864, Carson had nearly perished against Comanches and Kiowas at Adobe Walls. Van Dorn and Chivington had had their massacres, but the experience of the ebullient and egocentric Captain William Fetterman in 1866 more closely approximated the real risks of Western Command. Oozing self-confidence and itching to kill savages, Fetterman led 80 men out from Fort Phil Kearny in Wyoming on December 21st, under orders to rescue a wagon train of woodcutters that was under attack by Red Cloud's Oglala Sioux. He was warned twice that he should do nothing more than escort the woodcutters back to the fort. Instead of following those orders, Fetterman plunged ahead looking for Indians to shoot. He spotted a small and vulnerable-looking group of Sioux warriors and pursued them. He soon discovered that they had been put there as bait. He thus rode directly into ambush. Exactly how many Indians took part in the attack is not known. Enough to kill 80 troopers in less than 20 minutes. In his report to his superiors, Post Commandant Henry Carrington listed some of the items he found on the battlefield the next day. Eyes torn out and laid on rocks. Noses and ears cut off. Teeth chopped out. Brains taken out and placed on rocks. Hands and feet cut off. Private parts severed. The Oglala seemed especially annoyed at two men who carried brand new 16-shot Henry repeating rifles. Presumably, they had done a good deal of damage. Their faces had been reduced to bloody pulp, and one of the men had been pierced by 105 arrows.